Walter Mondale. He didn't do it very effectively, but he was did it. Maybe Jesse Jackson, except that he had other things going as well. But it's really the 1980s, and I think the lesson the Democrats took from that election that didn't go so well in 1984 is we need to give up class politics. Well, they did. West Virginia used to be a Democratic stronghold. Dukakis was one of the few states he took in 1988. It is now probably one of the reddest states, despite the fact of the matter. And I think a number of people will think, well, you know, coal miners are so reactionary. They're not reactionary. This is the coal miner unions have a long history of very progressive, even radical union activity. They were the only unions during World War II to buck the national injunction against strikes. They're the only ones to strike. Even the longshoremen didn't strike during World War II. Many people on the left, particularly those who go to college, watch John Sayles, Mate Juan. You know, the coal miners there were heroes. Well, you know, the coal industry is unfortunately in trouble, but you know, the people that we're talking about are a natural progressive constituency. They are people who are probably hurting the worst from basically the division between rich and poor in this country. We need to start talking about that again. We tend to not want to talk about the fact that probably one of the largest problems in this country and a lot of all the other issues stem from it is we have very few people, the 1%, as we've heard, and we have everybody else. And throughout history, when the 99% are divided, they lose. And again, we can debate as to whether or not Hillary Clinton was a candidate of the 99%. Another time. I don't really want to get into that so much as I want to introduce my guest. We also have an impression sometimes, particularly on what we call the left coast, that progressives, are, and the right wing uses this, an image, to basically falsify it, and we all play into it, that you have to be in a place like New York City or San Francisco or a college town to be progressive. And that's not true. We have a long, rich tradition of working class intellectuals from the heartland in this country. Woody Guthrie from Oklahoma, Jack London. Jack Kerouac was an intellectual, not a big fan of his politics, but he was a thinker from the working class. Irving Howe, Dorothy Healy. These are people who were intellectuals, not because they were able to go to college. Most of them weren't able to do that, although some of them did eventually make it into college. But they were working class people who picked up books, who thought, who hung around people who were educated, and they learned. And when you blend working class background with intellectualism, more often than not, the ideological result is socialism. That is, go figure, right? And as for socialism having to be located in New York City or San Francisco, consider that, the probably the most successful socialist candidate in our history, Eugene Debs, was from Indiana. His successor, Norman Thomas, who ran on the Socialist Party for years and years, was from Ohio. Robert La Follette from Wisconsin. We have a rich tradition in this country, and we're losing it. And my guest tonight is in that tradition. He is an intellectual. He is 20 years old. He is a child and grandchild and great-grandchild of coal miners. His resume is he works at the Waffle House. He has plans to do other things, but he is an intellectual. And when you hear him, if his interview with the Young Turks has gone viral, when you hear him or you read his writings, I believe he wrote something for the Washington Post. His politics, his political understanding is more advanced than a lot of people with advanced degrees. I want to introduce Nick Smith. Nick, are you on the line?
I'm here.
All right. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself? Maybe tell us, you know, how did you, you do consider yourself a socialist, correct?
Absolutely. I am a self-identified socialist.
And what does that mean to you?
Well, I believe, first of all, I put workers' rights and class struggle above a lot of things. I believe in a unified working class where we socially control the means of production. I'm an anti-capitalist, and I believe that capitalism has caused so much division and destruction. It's an unsustainable system, and it's a system where the fruits of our labor, you know, the wealth that we create, we don't really see. So I would like a system where we redistribute that wealth among the people that produce it.
Now, where are you from?
I'm from Dickinson County, Virginia. I was born in Norton, which is a small city of about 2,000 people. It's technically not in Wise County, Virginia, because Virginia is strange in that our cities are independent from the counties. So technically it's Norton City, Virginia, but geographically it's within Wise County. But I was raised in Trammell, Virginia, about an hour away. There's no hospital between Trammell and Norton. But I grew up in Trammell, Virginia for, you know, over half my life. And Trammell was actually built by a coal company back in the 1910s.
That was a company town at one time, right?
It was.
Yeah.
So I grew up in a holler above Trammell. You know, Trammell, you know, it had a company store that was later turned into a post office. And then in the 1970s, it turned into basically an abandoned building with a Coca-Cola sign out front. There's nothing more than that.
And, you know, tell us about the community. I mean, what is it like? Who lives in these places where you are from and where you're living now?
Well, basically the same families that have been living there since the 1910s. Most of the family I have in there, their last name is Phillips. They were there before Trammell was there. You know, Phillips Holler's been around, you know, according to, you know, county records, since before Trammell was built. The first person in the town was a man named Hiram Keith, never married, never had kids. And after him, it was the Phillipses, and they're still there. What we see is people in Trammell, you know, people actually, you know, in Appalachia in general, in a lot of rural areas, they tend to not really stray far from home. You know, they either get out, get a job, whatever, get married. A lot of them move their family, you know, back to the hills, just kind of expand out, move further up the mountain, clear out their little plot. You know, their kids do the same thing, and, you know, family kind of stays in the same area. But we've seen that Trammell's getting closer and closer to a ghost town as, you know, job opportunities keep disappearing and disappearing and disappearing. But, I mean, now a lot of people who don't have ties to Trammell are kind of moving in just because it's the cheapest place there. I mean, you've got only 30 houses in Trammell. There's no stores, no post office. You know, a lot of houses are burned down, you know, falling apart, dilapidated. I mean, Trammell is just a depressing sight to drive through.
Now, what do these people, do the people around you, do they even think about politics, or, and when they do, how do they lean, or what is the thinking?
Well, there's been a distrustment I'll need to go back a little bit, and
sure.
I think you've definitely hit the nail on the head and took about half my talking points in the introduction. I loved it so much, talking about how Appalachia, you mentioned West Virginia, and that's the only all-Appalachian state, but the coal country voter for the longest time has been, leaning slightly to the left, has been mainly Democrat, and that doesn't mean socially progressive necessarily. That's, you know, one of the problems that we still face is a socially reactionary politics, but still gun-toting, Bible-thumping Democrats, you know, for the longest time. well, now it's not acceptable to be that, and, you know, there's some reason for that. But people in my family have voted Democrat for a long time. There's a lot of people in that area that have voted Republican a long time. Actually, the Rasnick family, there's two different ones, and depending on whether their name was C or CK, you could tell whether they voted Republican or Democrat. But see, the thing is, Appalachia, see, people in this country, they see now that the 1%, the ruling class, who controls campaign financing, you know, these big corporate executives, really dominate our politics because, oh, well, they're going to give their money to candidates to look out for them. It's a self-regulating system, you know, and people in Appalachia have known that for a long time. You look at the Battle of Blair Mountain, you know, here it is. Well, and, you know, to the listeners who aren't aware of the Battle of Blair Mountain, what happened was back in 1921, this was back when, you know, companies owned whole towns like Trammell. Actually, Trammell was owned by Coal Company. They owned the stores. They owned everything. They pretty much owned your way of life. You know, they didn't pay you in U.S. dollars. They paid you in company scrip.
Right.
And you paid it back to them. And when you went on strike, when you went to go fight for your rights, they would send
Pullman.
People, well, we called them gun thugs, but I think the proper term was private detectives, to basically come and break up the strike and threaten you. Well, this law enforcement officer in May 1, West Virginia, stood up against these gun thugs who were evicting workers from their homes. He rounded up a posse and, you know, handled that business. Well, he was arrested for murder.
Yeah.
And he was tried and he was acquitted. Well, sure enough, on the foot of the doorstep, you know, the steps, the steeple over at the courthouse, he got shot.
Mm.
And the people that shot him did not get convicted either. Well, there was protests out in Charleston, West Virginia. I mean, massive protests, and they ended up getting out of hand. And these mine workers end up, you know, going into what pretty much armed revolution. You know, they rioted, started seizing guns anywhere they could. Hell, they stole a train. You know, and these 10,000 mine workers went to march down to Mingo County or Logan County, I forget which one it was, to, you know, back down to, you know, Mayo. And there was some law enforcement that was anti-union, you know, for the company, but they went down there armed to the teeth, basically, to, you know, to settle this, you know, this problem. And there was a large confrontation on Blair Mountain, West Virginia,
right,
where these 10,000 miners went up against 3,000 company thugs, as well as West Virginia state troopers and local law enforcement. Well, they dropped bombs on the mine workers. They had machine gun nests set up, you know, against the mine workers and all that. Well, President Harding at the time, he heard about this, and he's like, because keep in mind, 4 years ago, the communist revolutions in Russia happened. 1917 wasn't too long ago. He's like, that's happening right now. We need to get rid of that. So he sent the U.S. Army down. You know, did he side with the workers who were being abused, who were beaten, who were being neglected, who were being killed out there by the coal companies? No, they sided with the coal companies, and they arrested workers by the hundreds and thousands and tried them.
Yeah.
And that's part of our history.
So that's a very radical history. Entire community up against the 1% and their thugs, basically.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. The government always has sided with big business.
Yeah. With the exception, there is a movie that John Sayles did that's loosely based on it. It's a composite story. It wasn't the coal, it wasn't Mate One where where they brought in black strike breakers who eventually joined the strike. It was a composite story with an auto workers strike from Michigan, but he wanted to get in as much as he could with a feeling of the history. But it does talk a little bit about that, and I think it was was it Pullman that was were the thugs that were hired? I'm trying to remember.
I think I know the answer to this. Who were the...
It doesn't matter. Remember,
they were in Roanoke.
They still do security, private security, is my
Pinkerton. The Pinkerton.
Pinkertons, that's it. Not Pullman, right?
That's
Pullman
who it was.
Railroad, yeah. Well, what I want to ask you, though, is because how is it that you personally arrived at a socialist view of things? Obviously, not everybody around you is voting socialist, so how did you arrive at this?
Well, we got to understand that Appalachia is in America, and we have, for the longest time, had anti-socialist propaganda shoved in our face from the Cold War. I mean, that's an entire generation of people. You know, you have the baby boomers were, you know, born just before, just during the Cold War, and that's their whole lives. You know, you had Gen Xers born, you know, most of them, you know, Cold War, actually all of them, you know, during the Cold War, and, you know, they lived to see, you know, two Germanys. They didn't know Russia as an entity. They knew the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
So that still resonates, and Appalachia, because it's very rural, doesn't progress as fast, and that's because of a few factors. One, communication is a little bit different, because we haven't had high-speed internet until just a couple years ago.
Mm.
You know, in some areas, you know, more urban parts of Appalachia, you know, have had it longer than others. You know, cable television, you know, we haven't had as long as everybody else has had it. But also, we live around family. People don't question their values in rural areas as much as in other areas because of fear of, you know, social judgment. There's a lot of clinging to tradition. That's not to put down rural America, but that's just how it is globally in rural areas. They typically, you know, you don't want to upset granny, you know, go to church.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's just kind of how it is. But there's a lot of misconceptions, miseducations, and intentional misinformation about socialism in this country. You even just watch the first Democratic debates, you can see Anderson Cooper's, you know, smug bourgeois face, you know, trying to call Bernie Sanders out on socialism. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
And that's in the mainstream. He's liberal.
Right. It is. One thing he did do was remove a lot of fear of the word, but really any other country he would be considered left of center.
Yeah, he wouldn't be considered very far left at all in a lot of countries.
Yeah. Yeah. The question is, how did you arrive?
I've always had my nose in a book or really on a computer screen. I'm a big, you know, media person. I'm a TV watcher. You know, I've always liked to question norms. My parents have always been kind of in the liberal left. And they've taught us to, you know, me and my brothers, I got two brothers, an older one and a younger one, to question and critically think about things around us, and also to be involved in the political process, you know, to be, you know, involved in things that affect us. You know, they've always said, you know, vote, but understand what you're voting for. You know, they always have. You know, my grandfather, he was in the Pittston coal strike in 1989, where the coal company cut health care benefits across the board for its workers, and, you know, the UMWA decided, okay, these people going on strike. Well, they went on strike in states like West Virginia, Pennsylvania, and stuff that had that were not right to work. Well, they got their benefits real quick, but here in Virginia, where we've been right to work since like the 40s or 30s.
And right to work, that's basically where people can work at a place that has established a union contract, and they don't have to be part of that contract. They don't have to pay union dues. So union members end up having to cover for them.
Absolutely, but there's also some things on top of that. There's zero protections for your job against scabs. There's all kinds of other things. Actually, under right to work, they can legally fire you for no reason. They don't need a reason to legally fire you. No, I can't discriminate based off the color of your skin, but I can fire you just cause.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of things going right to work. Actually, in the state of Virginia, state employees cannot join unions. I was actually surprised the first time I heard of a teacher's union. I'm like, they have teacher's unions? Because, you know, in the state of Virginia, you cannot unionize as a state employee.
Actually, you have so two national unions.
Yeah, there's a lot of things they tack on to right to work. Really, right to work is your right to work for less and with less representation. But either way, the UMWA here in the coal fields of Virginia went on strike, and my grandfather was part of that, and they went on strike for months. I mean, months. You know, they were out on the picket line, and, you know, the coal companies didn't like that, and the governor, you know, actually sent, he deployed, I'm going to use the word deployed, a mass of state troopers down to the southwestern part of the state where we mine coal to basically break up the strikes. Because, you know, they went on strike, okay, well, scabs got hired. You know, scabs were driving the coal trucks, scabs worked in the mines. So the union action was, okay, we're going to block the roads so these scabs can't go in. We're going to lie in the middle of the road and so they can't get through. Well, state troopers, what did they do? They would drag people off the picket line. They would, you know, arrest them for obstructing traffic or civil disobedience or whatever they could throw on them, you know. And that went on for a while, and, you know, they decided to get into more radical actions, and, you know, this did go on for months, and there was wildcat strikes. There were people going against the union's wishes to actually further the workers' agenda. Somebody that I knew growing up who I can't name, because I don't think my family would want me to name them, but they actually had stolen some explosives and actually blew up a power transformer so electricity couldn't go in the mines. And, you know, that helped further. It's like, okay, well, scabs literally can't work because nobody can work because there's no electricity. And that person ended up going to federal prison over that. But the biggest action that won in the contract was the Moss 3 power plant in Dickinson County, Virginia. They occupied that. And what happened was 100 mine workers, they, with, you know, without telling anybody where they were going, they went early one morning, you know, and basically wedged their way into the power plant, all dressed in camouflage. You know, there were guard dogs outside. They were all male. Well, they took female dog urine, you know, distracted these dogs, you know, and then they went in through the mine, and the early morning workers there at the power plant, you know, the 100 people in camouflage came in and said, yeah, we're inspectors here at the power plant. You know, y'all need to get out while we inspect. Well, here it is. You're a scab worker. What are you going to do? You really, you know, 100 people in camouflage come in. You're not going to question. You're like, okay, you're the inspector. All right, got it. You know, so they left, but they occupied the power plant for, you know, 3 or 4 days. You know, they just decided to lock themselves in the power plant and just sit in, you know. Well, they, you know, police showed up, they threatened, but, you know, I think it was 5,000 people, you know, showed up outside the power plant, you know, blocking the roads, basically to show solidarity with these, you know, workers. But after, you know, Moss 3 was occupied for a couple days, they actually won the contract. They said, okay, you know, you're getting your health benefits.
Right.
But that was, my grandfather was part of that. He was arrested, you know, protesting, you know, during the coal strikes of 1989, and that was not long ago at all. You know, my parents were alive for that, and they participated in a school walkout. You know, their high school, they walked out, you know, of class, you know, along with most of the school. That was Irvington High School, you know, in Dickinson County, Virginia. So that's a big part of my family's history. But as far as the socialist conclusions, well, I've always I considered myself a liberal until I was about 17 years old, because just like most Americans, that's the only acceptable form of left-wing thought.
Listen, let me get some people caught up here and then invite callers, and then I've got a question to take you because you're getting into sort of the topic of the show. You're listening to KHSU. My name is Eric Kirk. My guest is Nick Smith. We are going to be moving into the discussion about classism on the left. If you want to join the conversation, this is Thursday Night Talk. Phone number is 826-4805, or if you're out of the area, 1-800-640-5911. That's 826-4805 or 800-640-5911. And I want to talk about this because obviously if you were to walk into San Francisco or New York City, probably dressed as you do and talking as you do, people would make a lot of assumptions about you. I'm sure it's happened.
It even happens here in Roanoke, and I'm still in, you know, a pretty rural region of the South.
And the assumption is that people who are wearing camo, who are into guns, maybe watch Duck Dynasty. I'm sure you're probably not interested
in that. Oh, I hate
Duck
Dynasty.
I know. I'm just saying. But there's a way that people are looked down on for it. I mean, you know, I want to talk about that because you were very angered by a Cost post. Daily Cost, of course, is probably the largest liberal blog in the country. And he said something really condescending is probably an understatement. Do you recall the column?
Was this the one saying that that mine workers who lost their health care benefits deserved it?
Yep.
Those ones?
Yeah.
Ooh, that made me irate. Yeah, angry would also be an understatement. I was irate.
And he said this, and I've seen this online where people saying, hey, they voted for Trump, so they asked for it. I mean, why would somebody, why are coal workers or people who are unemployed or are parts of the community, why do they vote for Trump?
Well, why do people that are victims of kidnapping identify with their oppressors?
Mm-hmm.
You know, identify with their captors. It's Stockholm Syndrome 101. You know, before the coal industry came in, these areas were pre-industrial agrarian. They were far behind the rest of the country, you know, when it came to, you know, way of living, et cetera. So the economic development of Appalachia has been under the thumb of the coal companies. And, you know, they basically built the infrastructure there to keep people in and get coal out. There's railroads that go all through Appalachia, even Trammell, as small as we were. We didn't have any stores, but we had a railroad go through us. But there's no passenger rail in central Appalachia. I've not heard of one. If there is, they don't have any in Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so meant to get coal out, keep people in. It basically to exploit us and dehumanize us, you know, just because of the coal under our feet. But we also understand that everything we've had in economic development has been because of the coal industry. Just look at West Virginia politics. You see pro-coal Democrats running, and you see pro-coal Republicans running. These are the only people that, see, no one else wanted to invest money in the politics of West Virginia, but the coal companies sure as heck will. And they'll give their money, you know, to, you know, two sides of the same coin. So no matter who, you know, wins, you know, the workers, the people of Appalachia lose. But, you know, the coal company is always on top, whether it's Republican or Democrat. You just look at Joe Manchin, the last governor we had in West Virginia. He was a Democrat. He was actually for union rights, anti-right to work. You know, he wasn't really a fan of environmental regulations.
Yeah.
He wasn't a fan, you know, of a lot of these things. He was one of these people accusing Obama of a war on coal.
Right.
You know, so that's the only acceptable politics. But the thing is, it's true. No one else other than the coal companies is investing in these people. You know, right. There is a lack of social investment, especially on the left. The right wing doesn't invest in anybody. And the left wing, you know, the American general liberal left wing doesn't invest in us at all. So you have Hillary Clinton, for example. she was saying, we're going to shut down coal-fired power plants. You know, Obama before them, you know, and Obama's really when you start to see the shift towards voting Republican. Yeah. There are some speculations people can make on that, that it had more to do than coal, and for some people that's right, for other people not so much. But Obama said, yeah, you can open up a coal power plant, but we're going to make it so expensive that, you know, you can't do it. Right. Well, Trump comes along and says, no, we're going to put miners back to work. You know, well, even if you don't like Trump, and I know people in Dickinson County that think that he is, you know, just a terrible, terrible person, you know, that he represents New York values, that this person, you know, is rich, he's really out of touch.
But he's making a promise, and at least they're hoping that maybe there's a chance he can deliver something.
Absolutely. There's a small sliver of hope. But on top of that, the business-as-usual politics has been killing our region because our region's been dying since it was first developed. Business-as-usual has always harmed the American workers all across the country. But, you know, we definitely feel it here in Appalachia. Well, Donald Trump, he speaks, you know, more like me, you know, than he does like, you know, Hillary Clinton. He doesn't use big words to fluff up his language. He doesn't, you know, he basically breaks down complex, well, he doesn't actually break down complex ideas and make them simple. He just oversimplifies big ideas. I think that's one thing where he and I differ. But he speaks plainly, he speaks bluntly, and he'll even intentionally say ridiculous, offensive things just so that he can, you know, claim that he's speaking plain and blunt.
And get the kind of reaction from more affluent liberals that divide the stuff, yeah. Listen, yeah, I want to take a call real quick, and then we'll come back to your point. But we've got Linda, our first caller. You're on the air.
Hey, guys. How's it going?
Linda.
Going good, Linda.
All right. Hey, I have kind of a complicated question for you.
All right.
So there's a really strong history in this country of people in power advancing their means by turning lower-class whites against people of color. And a lot of my conversations that I have with friends who are of color, and we kind of get back a lot to the fact that I am white has allowed me to ascend like a lower middle class position in a way that they might necessarily have been able to because of institutionalized racism. So my question for you is, how do we advance, you know, the conversation around class while simultaneously acknowledging that we do have a position of privilege because of institutional racism?
Well, the thing is, I do absolutely agree that politics in this country has pitted the white worker against workers of color. You know, and actually, if you look back at the plantation South, what we saw was that these systems were very intentionally, not even accidentally, put in place to give preference to the white worker, because in all honesty, you know, working out in the field, oftentimes, you know, the poor white farmhand, you know, sharecropper or what have you, was working either just across the fence, working the same field as slaves. Now, keep in mind, they had their citizenship. They were not owned. They were not, you know, beaten for not performing things right, and their kids weren't owned. So it's not nearly the same level of oppression whatsoever. But the farm worker absolutely saw more in common with the slave, or would by default, than the person that owns, you know, the land that they're both working on. So people at the top, these landowners, know that. They were smart to be like, okay, we need to find some way to distance them. Well, thus came a lot of the jobs in slave patrols. Thus came a lot of the laws that said, you know, poor white workers were allowed to beat slaves, you know, anytime they got out of line, giving, you know, preference to the white work, very obvious preference, that still kept the white worker down. But as we've seen, you know, us progress, you know, in politics, I mean, there's still major, major white privilege in this country. But what we really see is that people living in largely poor white communities don't see this privilege. It exists. It's still there, but it's like a tree falling in the woods. These, you know, people in Appalachia don't see black poverty. They understand that, you know, the issues of poverty because they live through, because their region as a whole is kept intentionally poor. But really, Central Appalachia is the only large patch of white poverty in this country. There are little dots here and there of, you know, white poverty, but they're not large scale because of, you know, systematic racism. But because of these tiny isolated pockets of white poverty here and there, it's easier to convince these people that white privilege doesn't exist. It's, and that's what they've been doing. They see, you know, that, because the fact is, there's only two things that cause crime, and that's poverty or mental illness. Well, poor white communities have a lot of crime, you know, not a lot of violent crime because they're largely rural, but a lot of property crime, a lot of drug crime, similar to these urban areas, yet they're not arrested at nearly the same rates, they're not convicted, and they're sure as heck not being killed by police at nearly the same rates. Well, but the crimes are still being committed, so it's easy to tell these people, listen, you're going through these problems exist in your community, but, you know, you're not out here doing this. They like, it's getting them to blame the victims of worse oppression, because they see that they're living very similar to communities of color that are poor. So if you say, no, okay, so you're poor, they're poor, what's the difference? And there's this misconception, what they're being told is, you know, their culture is broken. Fact is, you know how to behave around cops. They don't. And that's simply untrue, you know, but that's what it is. Or, you know, that, like, somehow it's their fault. Or the blue-collar industries across the country, which are actually dominated by the, you know, white working class, these jobs that get you, you know, out of poverty without education, you know, there's white supremacy plays a factor in, you know, giving a lot of people a leg up. But these jobs have been declining for a long time. And simultaneously, illegal immigration has been increasing because things south of the border are not, have not been going good for a while. It's easy to say, oh, no, the problem with, you know, decline of blue-collar industry has to do with the immigrants coming over here. You know, it's actually, you know, the people that are willing to work for less than you, that the company's given preference towards, which I think is contradictory right there. You know, they're to blame. But really, I think exposure helps with that, but not demonizing the ignorance because these people are being intentionally misinformed, you know, in these communities. It takes a certain level of understanding. You got to reach that olive branch. And really, I think the conversation starts with shared mutual issues that the poor white community and poor communities of color face. If you can say, hey, we're in this boat together, I think that's where the conversation starts.
All right. Linda, do you have a follow-up?
I guess my only other follow-up question, I'll take the answer off the air, is what role, Nick Phil's, the mainstream media or popular conceptions of poor white folks plays in perpetuating the stereotype of racism?
Thank you, Linda.
I couldn't hear that question too well. What was that?
What role do you see the national media in playing in maintaining negative stereotypes of white working class people?
Well, I think the biggest thing is because white supremacy is so strong in, you know, cities like New York, cities like Los Angeles, things like that, you don't see white poverty there. So the narrative I've seen is that poor white people are poor because it's their fault. You know, there's a lot of victim blaming when it comes to white poverty. And I personally think there's a lot of white supremacist attitude in that. You know, these people will, a lot of liberals will, you know, condescendingly support, you know, the rights of, you know, black workers. But, you know, I'm sure you've seen the comments online that say, oh, Nick works at Waffle House. Why doesn't he get an education? Why doesn't he, you know, go somewhere else? But the fact is, financially, I've got the same obstacles, you know, as a black worker in the same situation. I don't deal with other obstacles, you know, with that circle around that, but specifically with financial obstacles, it's the same.
All right, let's take that. Go ahead, finish the thought. I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah, no, I apologize. I'm a rambler, you know, so conversationally, you know, that's a problem I got.
All right, let's take one more call, another call. Maureen,
yeah, absolutely.
From Arcata. Go ahead.
Yeah. Oh, hi. It's a little difficult to begin since I haven't been part of the conversation, but I'm going to attempt to do that in that the things that run through my head are... you know, having a conversation, and also, as I'm listening, I always come up with who told the first lie and what was it? Because we're still dealing with it. We're still dealing with lies.
And what specific lie are you referring to, Bernie?
Yeah, okay. Okay, well, the one that I come closest to as to the beginning of is the lie of separation. And then that makes all other lies possible.
Okay.
And I know that's deep and like we've been talking and maybe that takes a little while to process, but I've processed it and that was the first lie. That we were separate from each other in any way, that there was any prejudice ever to come into being. Like, why are men and women not getting along? Isn't that disappointing?
All right, let's Nick take it, and then we'll move on.
Yeah, go.
Thank you. Go ahead, Nick.
Yes, thank you.
No, I actually think that was pretty profound. And that's another example of you don't need a lot of words, a lot of complex, you know, thoughts really be profound, but absolutely. Solidarity, you know, seeing the similarities and struggles and understanding why these divisions exist and kind of closing that gap is the most important. Working class solidarity is the way we achieve things in this country. By saying to the, you know, to the immigrant worker, hey, you make $7 an hour doing what I do for 10, and as a result, I don't have a job, and you're being paid nothing. You and I need to go up there and fight for, you know, workers' rights for you and for me. You know, seeing, you know, the black worker and say, hey, we're both making less than $15 an hour. We both don't have union representation. Our schools are both, you know, failing. There's a lack of investment in our communities from the people up top. You know, our schools are underfunded. They're shutting down. Our public health is worse than any other communities in this country. Our life expectancies are low. Our teen pregnancies are high. You know, you and I need to come together under the banner of the working class, and we can address our class issues, and then I will stand for the racial issues you face that I don't. And then you will stand for the regional issues I face in Appalachia that you don't go through. You know, and I really do think it's a lot worse to be a black worker in America than an Appalachian worker, but, you know, we're not doing oppression Olympics here. We need You know, I'm glad you appreciate that term.
Yeah.
But it's not about oppression Olympics. It's about solidarity.
No.
When
we
stand for common issues and I stand for your issues, you will stand for my issues. So, and I think key is identifying who is dividing us and why. And the thing is, the capitalist class, the 1% is now what we call them. At one point, they were called the bourgeois, but I like the 1%. It's kind of applicable, you know, when you look at wealth concentration nowadays. But the 1% is who keeps us divided, and they keep us divided so that we don't do exactly what I'm describing. Because, see, the majority of the working class in this country are people of color, yet the largest group of working class are whites, mainly because we're a 75% white country. But they need us white workers to be the foot soldiers of oppression, you know, because it's not the 1% that are out there lynching people. It's not the 1% that's out there, you know, committing acts of police brutality. It's not them. It's people in the working class white community. All we need to do is say, no, we won't do it anymore, because I like the black working class a lot better than I like your ivory tower looking down on me.
All right, let me do a little station ID here real quickly. We're getting towards the top of the hour. Phone number, if you want to join, but really quickly, is 826-4805 or 1-800-640-5911 if you're out of the area. That's 826-4805 or 800-640-5911. We are talking with Appalachian. Am I saying that right? Because I always say Appalachia. How do you say it?
Appalachian, like a latch on the door.
Appalachian political activist Nick Smith. You know, we are talking, the primary topic is classism on the left, but we also want to talk solutions and how we move beyond it. Obviously, there are ways, but we'll take one more call, and then I want to try to close it out. Mike in Willow Creek, you're on the air.
I don't know how you found this young man, but I'm sold. Nick, I think this 35 is the age that you can start running for president.
He's got a few years before that.
He's got a few years. I'm extremely impressed. I'm kind of blown away to be hearing it at all. Everything he said shows what a bright, intelligent, resourceful young man he is. I can't imagine myself being 20 years old and come up with that intelligence and clearness. One thing I just wanted to say one more thing, that Kay Hum has a disc jockey in the morning named Bailey Brown. She's from West Virginia. If you guys could hook up with her and give another interview, that would be great, because the word Nick spreads has to be heard.
If you want to contact me after the show, Mike, I don't know. I don't get a chance to listen to the radio in the morning. I'm usually working, but I take requests in terms of topics and guests. So if you want to get a hold of me, that
after 8 o'clock.
Sure. Yeah. If you want to call back in, that'd be great.
Good. Thank you, Nick.
All right.
All right. You're very welcome. Thank you.
You're a very impressive young man.
All right. Well, and for the record, if anybody wants to find him, the way I discovered, I'm not even sure how I came across him, but there is a YouTube video. Look up Nick Smith, Young Turks interview. I'm sure it'll take you straight there on YouTube. It takes you to about a 5-minute long interview, and it's intended. I think the title of the video is, "Do You Think This Cold Country Person Voted for Trump," you know, that type of thing.
Short answer is no.
I can't listen to the news without hearing about Trump. I want to listen to Nick every night instead.
Yeah. Anyways, well, unfortunately, you'll be hearing a lot. But thank you, Mike. Nick, did you had something to say about the video?
Oh, no. I was saying the title, "Do You Think This Cold Country Southerner Voted for Trump?"
Yeah.
I just wanted to quickly say the answer is no. As 90% of the people who watch the video understand, there's that 10% that didn't get it, including Shink Uger of the Young Turks, because he emailed me. He was just curious, genuinely curious, like, so did you end up voting for Trump? And I kind of, you know, cussed him out, and I prefaced it with, "I appreciate your work, but first of all, you know," and he's like, you know,
I don't think he saw your video. It makes no sense.
I know it. I know. Well, he actually did a follow up video on my video. So, and at the end, he was like, "I don't know if he voted for Trump or not, but you know, he called me his favorite person in America right now, and so I guess I can't be mad at the guy. He's pretty all right."
I cannot imagine somebody who listened to what you said thinking you would have voted for Trump. But anyway, that doesn't make sense. We'll take one more call. Another Mike from Brookings, Oregon. You're on the air.
Thank you. Yeah, Nick, thank you very much for being there, and it's refreshing to hear a fine young man like yourself with some real, real good ideas. I do agree with you wholeheartedly. I was a Teamster trucker for 30 years, and I saw how good organized labor can be and then how it is now, and I just think that it's going to take some time before the great, you know, for everything to run full circle to where it gets back to where the working poor and the union man, you know, get something. You know, we get benefits, we get a pension, the things that we're not getting anymore. They aren't. I retired in January, so I just want to say thank you for being there, and keep going. I do appreciate it. I wish you best of luck.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate that.
Yeah,
well, you betcha.
The Teamsters has been up and down. I was a Teamster when I worked for UPS, and the union was really bad then. It went through a little bit of democratization in the 90s, but I've heard it's not too effective these days. But
not a shame.
Yeah, we'll see. Well, Nick, we've got about 7 minutes left, actually a little over 6 minutes. You know, we've identified the problem. There are elitist attitudes on the left, which, you know, alienate people. But real quickly, you said in the video, coal's not coming back. I mean, even if you were to strip back the environmental regulations, I think you mentioned that natural gas and other things are probably still going to undersell it. Is that still your analysis?
Oh, yeah, that has not changed one bit, and it's not going to change because mechanization of labor has first started taking away the jobs, and it's still going to. And now, you know, like I said, environmental regulations, well, I mean, you know, they're trying to strip those back. I mean, a lot of people don't know about mountaintop removal, but the coal companies are literally blowing up tops of mountains to go get the coal. And what's being blown up is going into the valleys and streams around the mountains, and it's getting the groundwater and it's giving people cancer. So even if we could bring coal back, I'd like to see another solution. You know, just play devil's advocate. Let's say all the coal jobs come back. If those are the jobs that are coming back, we don't want them.
Well, if we were to talk about Appalachia as a nation, it would be a third world nation if it's dependent on a single product, you know, for export, basically. So obviously, there's got to be some movement towards economic diversity, you know, but how to do that? And is there anybody, as you say, are the 1% willing to invest in it? Probably not.
No, they're not. And in fact, if it were its own country, it would be a colony. A lot of people don't realize this because you see, if you just look at a map of public land in this country, most of Appalachia is private land. Well, you'd think, oh, okay, so local farmers, landowners own it. No, that's not it. You know, the vast majority of the land in coal country is owned by coal companies, land holding groups, etc. You know, I grew up in a holler, you know, in the woods, you know, about half a mile, you know, up a gravel driveway from Trammell, and we were on 1 acre of land that we didn't even own. We rented it. We owned the house. My family built the house during, I think, my great-grandfather's generation, but we didn't own the land. We rented it. And it was only the 1 acre around the house. So beyond that, you know, all the woods around my house were owned by coal companies. So they control the wealth. They control the land. So they also control the development. Mm-hmm. So we need government intervention, you know, as well as the private sector to pick up. And the reason so many people support coal jobs there, even though they're so harmful, is because they're not seeing anyone that will invest. I think if we built some more four-lane roads through some of these very, very rural counties, I believe if we had legalized marijuana, legalized industrial hemp, and put hemp processing plants in these areas, hemp paper mills, whatever, that could actually help with the economy. But until then, all we have is coal.
Are you speaking to Humboldt County? We're sort of the cold county of marijuana here. But we're getting to the top of the hour here. We have less than 3 minutes left. Do you have any thoughts that you can express on that as to how we overcome classism, how we make it so that people like Koss, who mean well, don't write columns like that, and have some sort of solidarity? Do you have any thoughts on how we can reach that?
I think the first thing to do in the progressive left is to stop blaming the victim. And y'all don't blame the victim when it comes to, you know, poor workers of color, and you definitely shouldn't. That's happening on y'all, not on our part, and we need to stop that. But what I've seen is question, why is it when you see a poor black man, a poor white man, even living in a poor area, you think, oh, well, that white man did it to himself? And I think a lot of that comes from a subconscious mentality that the whole settler, colonial, white supremacist culture of the United States has put in your head that whites are superior. And they're not. We are not. So question, why do you feel a certain way? And on the part of the working class white folks, we need to identify more with people that are on the left and really workers of color, you know, and their struggles than anything else. So really empathy. Empathy is the biggest thing I'm asking for, you know, and identifying who the enemy is. We are not the enemies of the liberal left. The liberal left chose to condescend us. You know, so definitely, but the 1% wants you to do that, and they want us to resent y'all. And we're not going to let the 1% divide us. All right, I'm in it with y'all if y'all are in it with me.
That's a perfect ending, Nick. I want to thank you. I will invite you back. We'll probably have topics later, but I really want to thank you for spending the time. I know it's late back there for you, but thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much for having me on here. I appreciate it.
We'll talk to you soon. And I want to thank the callers for the thoughts. And, we're really getting close to the end here. So until next time, we will pick this topic up again. I want to thank everybody. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Thursday Night Talk here on KHSU. Thanks to our host, Eric Kirk, and our guest, Nick Smith. And thank you to all of the community for your thoughtful input. Thanks to KHSU's Thursday Night Talk producer, Geraldine Goberg. Our theme music is composed and performed by Jeff Kreider. Stay tuned to KHSU. No Room for Squares is up next.
On the next Thursday Night Talk, The Race Beat with Lorna Bryant will host a KHSU live broadcast and town hall meeting in Humboldt State University's Kate Buchanan Room. The topic is the Trump presidency, our country, our California, our community, our campuses. The community is invited to participate in the discussion for this live two-hour event. Doors open at 5:30.
Donors to KHSU include six...